Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Today, the Roundtable continues its series of important programs on problems of Asia. To open today's discussion on how can we win friends in Asia, we present Theodore W. Schultz, economist of the University of Chicago. And now, Mr. Schultz.
Asia is dramatically in the forefront today as President Truman, General MacArthur report their meeting out in the Pacific. The turn of the tide in Korea once again provides the opportunity to help develop a united and, one would hope, a peaceful and progressive Korea. We are now, however, under the necessity of developing, as I see it, concrete and specific plans in this part of the world. Yet the leaders of Asia are apprehensive as to how this opportunity is going to be used. Certainly Americans are deeply concerned about our role in Asia. Now, we have two men here today as guests participating in this University of Chicago Roundtable who have had extremely enriched experiences in the Orient. Dr. Clyde Mitchell, who is head of the Department of Agricultural Economics at Nebraska University, has had 3 years' experience in Korea. Now, out of that set of insights, Dr. Mitchell, what do you say? What is the heart of this Asiatic problem when we focus on social and economic progress for them?
Schultz, I say that Asia is in revolution. A revolution in which a 17th century culture is hauling itself forward into the 20th. It's a revolution made inevitable by the advances of scientific development in the rest of the world.
Dr. Raymond Moyer is also joining us. Now, he has had actually more than 2 decades of on-the-ground experiences in parts of the Orient and is today leaving for Formosa, where he has been and is the head of the ECA mission of this country to Formosa. Now, Dr. Moyer, what do you see as the core of this problem?
I would say that one of the most important factors in the present situation and of our problem arises out of the fact that these countries are, as we have sometimes said, underdeveloped. We speak of underdeveloped often in terms of economic underdevelopment. It applies in all phases of the life of these countries. Underdeveloped in concepts, a concept of government for public welfare. Underdeveloped in ability and experience in handling governmental affairs. Then there's increased expectations in these countries. The people of most of these lands are no longer willing to put up with conditions under which they have lived in the past. They're expecting something better. Also, we don't have 100 years in which to do what we might like to do helpfully in helping them to realize their increased expectations. Were conditions peaceful, there would be a gradual evolution in which this development would take place. We do not have peaceful conditions today.
Moyer, I'd say that some power, a group of powers, is going to help Asia achieve this social and industrial revolution quickly. The Soviet Union has seized the initiative. Her ruthlessness, her frankly imperialistic methods have frightened the world. But in an even more sinister manner, they have induced too many of us here at home to lose sight of the long-run objectives. Now, the long-run objectives are the abolition of feudalism, the industrialization, the assisting of these countries to live as 20th century nations should live. I submit that the UN nations have within our power the ability to stop Russia and to win the long-run battle at the same time.
Well, now, Mitchell and Moyer, as I listen to you, you have stated very well one important facet, a fundamental part of this problem, and that is catching up. But it has in it all the time the element of speed, a very rapid timetable. Now, how can they achieve this timetable without coercion, on our part without interference? Isn't that a basic dilemma that you are confronted with?
A certain amount of interference is necessary, Schultz, but it has to be done in a method that the backward areas of the world won't resent. I'm not at all sure the United States or any other one power can do it. That's why I look to the UN as being the coercive, the inducing force in inducing these backward governments to institute social reform.
It's still interference in some context. What do you say, Moyer?
There's no doubt that this presents a very serious and difficult problem for the United States. As an example, there appeared yesterday in the New York Times a dispatch from India in which Indian and Pakistan delegates to the Institute of Pacific Relations conference there spoke in this manner. These speakers implied the United States at best was bent upon some form of economic imperialism. and at worst, hope to use Asian lives as cannon fodder in a war against the Soviet Union.
Now, this is interference. This is imperialism in its emphasis. This is the apprehension of the Asiatic world that I referred to at the outset. Now, too often and usually in this posing of a problem, we get it at such a general level that we, in stating our means to very desirable objectives like you, Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Moyer stated at the outset here, get this, talking about divisions and dollars. Many divisions of force, military, armed services, and billions of dollars. I suggest today, because of your very unusual, rich experience in specific and concrete phases of what can be done in the Orient, in the Asiatic world, that we take advantage of this and see how much insights we can get from looking at the concrete. And I want to take advantage of you first here, Dr. Mitchell. You were head of the National Land Administration in Korea, as I said at the outset, through 46, 47, and 48. Now, out of that experience, what can we learn?
Truth, we ran a 25% land reform program in South Korea.
What's that? 25%?
I'll tell you what that means. We just had about one-fourth of the tenanted land in Korea to sell. Before I left the country in 48, we were able to put over the land sale job on the former Japanese land in Korea, but we never touched the land that was owned by the rich Korean landlord.
That was a mistake.
Well, it probably was. We won a little Cold War battle from the Russians in South Korea with that land sale, you know. The communists in North Korea had 2 years earlier, with much fanfare, put over their own brand of land reform, but we discovered that the Russian land reform in North Korea, which was advertised so highly, showed its face, as all communist reforms do after it's too late, to be complete mockery. We sold the Japanese land to the tenants in Korea for a reasonable price, but we didn't touch the land owned by the rich Korean landlords. We expected the government of Korea to do that after we left. But Syng Mun Rhee's rather reactionary administration, which our army occupation supported and let get into power, refused to finish the land reform job which we Americans started. Now, Rhee's government promised to complete land reform on the other three-fourths of the tenanted land, but we did not press him hard enough in Korea, and the total land reform, which I think would have helped fight communism in Korea, was never put into effect.
Now, Mitchell has emphasized rather strongly the one element here, this land tenure reform and land reform proper in Korea. Now, Dr. Moyer, you're going back in this experience in another part of the Orient, China proper, and more recently on Formosa, as a member of the Joint Commission on Rural Reconstruction, and then the notable program and achievements that you've had in Formosa. I think you ought to tell us, especially, the many elements that have come into your program there in Formosa from which we can then draw on as we proceed.
I think that this program of the Joint Commission on Rural Reconstruction, commonly referred to the JCRR program, is the most interesting and, to my mind, the most suggestive of the things with which I have been connected during the past 20 years of work more or less along these lines. U.S. participation in this joint endeavor was provided in the original China Aid Act. Essentially, we have developed a program in which we hope rather quickly, on as broad a scale as possible, to bring to the rural people things which will be of significant help to them and which they recognize are solving some of their problems. In general, we've had two objectives. One, the increase of agricultural production, but we've not been satisfied with that alone. We've attempted to look deeper into the situation and find what also would be necessary to improve living conditions of the rural people. In that search, we have gotten into land tenure reform. We have dealt with farmers' organization problems. We have done irrigation work, seed multiplication, handling of animal disease problems, human health problems. In these ways, attempting to do what we have set out to do.
Well, now, we want to draw on this experience because it is concrete, as I have said. Now, I like to pull out one thing that's been common to your emphasis in Korea, Mitchell, and yours in Formosa, and put it as a question. Why is land reform or land tenure reform so important?
Well, let me answer that, Jules. Land reform is important to economies that are 70, 80, 90% agricultural because the way the ownership of wealth has developed in the past, the really wealthy people of these countries attain their wealth through exploitation. It's not the same as wealth in the Western world, where wealth ordinarily means industrial prowess. But wealth in the Oriental world means ordinarily that a landowner has forced a little four-acre piece of soil to support two families, the tenant's family and the landlord's family. In my opinion, only by the abolition of absentee landlordism will we be able to lick the tenure problem in the Orient.
On the mainland of China and later on Formosa, we also went into this. We couldn't avoid getting into this problem. With the limited amount of land available, and with more tenants wishing to rent this land than there is land, tenants bid against each other. Without government regulation of this situation, the tenant very soon finds himself in a position in which he has barely enough to keep body and soul together. Under such a situation, there never can be either economic or social stability.
Well, I might disagree with the emphasis that you have placed, that this is necessarily exploitation. It may well be simply the stratification of property rights and the flows of income that go with them. We have engaged in reforms within our society, Western society, on the flows of income, the progressive income taxes, all of this kind. Now, when you touch land, the land's structure as it exists, don't you in fact have to reduce the claims, the income claims of the present owners of land, Mitchell?
I'd like to contrast the land reform in Japan and Korea, and maybe Moyo will add something about the land tenure reforms in Formosa. In Japan, the land reform was undertaken by the American occupation authorities in this way. The landlords were given bonds for their land, and
right,
the land sold to the tenants. But the value of the land in Japanese currency was so small because of the galloping inflation in Japan that it amounted to virtual confiscation of the landlord's land. Now, in South Korea, we sold the land for a reasonable price paid in grain. The tenants paid each year 20% of 1 year's crop.
How many years?
They were supposed to pay for 15 years.
Yes.
That means that the price of land was three times 1 year's production, which is not a bad price. Now, I think the tenants gained a great deal of stability in Western terms by paying what they knew was a reasonable price for the land. I think they were right for that new land ownership better than the tenants in Japan.
I would modify what you said, Mitchell, only in this respect, that it happened, perhaps an accident. One was put in terms of currency, yen, dollars, and the other was put in real terms. And since in Korea you put it in real terms, you avoided this inflation difficulty, which in a sense destroyed the purchasing power of the landlord's property when it was converted into the bond.
That's right, but I'm not at all sure that landlords should be expropriated as they were in Japan. I think landlords have a good deal of entrepreneurial ability that could well be put to work in the developing industrial enterprises of any of these backward areas.
Mr. Moyer.
My understanding of the situation in Japan is that the effect of the system was, as Mitchell has outlined, although that was not the original intention. It was a result of inflation, and I believe that the American authorities were opposed to elements in the situation, in the program as it eventually worked out, that they had in mind rather the kind of thing which eventually was carried out in Korea.
Now, Mattel, before you quit, though, Mr. Moyer here, tell us specifically how you affected a change in the position of the landowner in Formosa.
In Formosa, as well as on the mainland of China, most of the program had to do with limiting the amount of rent which a tenant paid.
More specifically?
It was on Formosa, it was reduced from the ordinary rent of 50% by 25%, making it 37.5%. Actually, many tenants paid 60 or 70%, but they were all reduced to 37.5%. On the mainland, it was also a 25% reduction, although in one place, in Guangxi province, they did almost exactly as Mitchell has outlined in Korea, setting a period of time over which a portion of the crop would be turned over in payment for the land.
Now, Moyer reports that this rent reduction scheme was very successful in Formosa. I'm certain from my own experience that a mere rent reduction scheme would not have been successful in Korea. There are ways landlords have of forcing a higher rent return, even though the legal limit might be one-third or 37%.
Did you have a black market or gray market pressure?
Sure, there are presents that have to be given to the landlord every harvest. Yes.
Now, the thing that I find that I want to draw out of this set of statements that you made about land reform before we go on to another important aspect, namely, there are these. Here you say, and I must concur, that land reform must take place.